Everyone, myself included, is facing career transformation. The workflows of knowledge workers are being upended by AI capabilities. What is it going to take to survive and ideally thrive in an AI-enabled workplace? I'm Thomas Law, the Executive Director of TSIA. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. And today, I'm going to be joined by Dr. Chris Deedy. He is a Senior Research Fellow at Harvard Graduate School of Education. And we will be discussing his research on learning new skills and the impact of AI on knowledge workers. So let's get the insight engine humming here. Welcome, Dr. Deedy. I'll refer to you as Chris here throughout. And I just wanted to start here to help ground our audience. Can you summarize some of the key focus areas of your research over the years? I know you've done work on 21st century skills, leveraging virtual and augmented realities, but just give people a sense of what you've been focused on in your research.
Well, I've actually been in the field for more than half a century, so I think I'll just talk about a couple things that are recent things, things for me, my current work.
Yeah.
So the United States has 29 national AI institutes, and I am the associate director for research for one of those, the one on adult learning and online education, which is basically the workforce reskilling, upskilling, and workforce entry is the focus. So that means that at this point, almost 4 years, I've been working with a team of AI experts on building tools for reskilling and upskilling and lifelong learning, and then putting them into the field and evaluating them and improving them and getting ready to do a lot of outreach to move those into the workplace and other adult learning settings. So that's one theme. I also, over the years and decades, have done a lot of work with immersive learning, XR, of different forms. And in recent years, I've worked with two companies, one called Mersion with a U, the other called Wanda with V-O-N-D-A, that both are using the opportunity to create immersive authentic simulations where you can practice asking your boss for a promotion, or you can practice French in rich French context, and so on. And those are things that I think are the future of work, that if you take 5 negotiation courses at Harvard and have a letter from a faculty member that says you did well in the courses, that doesn't really tell somebody whether you're a good negotiator or not. What tells them you're a good negotiator is if you can do a series of gauntlet of negotiation simulations. So that's, I think, an important area for the future. And then when the pandemic started, a co-founded podcast called Silver Lining for Learning that's about a successful edtech integration and transformation across the world. We thought we'd do 5 or 10 episodes at the start of the pandemic. We just taped episode 240.
Congratulations.
We have 240 hours of really interesting case studies of edtech around the world, a lot of it in global South countries with very limited resources. So those are 3 things that interrelate to one another and keep me busy.
Yeah, fantastic. It's interesting. The reason that I wanted to bring you on, and Janice Lee, our researcher who leads up education services and technology companies, highly recommended, you know, getting your perspective, is it is an interesting time for technology professionals. And right now, I personally, in the chair I sit in, I see 2 types of professionals in the industry. There are those, and again, regardless of their job, that are just aggressively experimenting with how to leverage AI to get work done. And then there's people that are literally still kind of barely touching it, right? They know it's there. They know it's something they should look at. And so from your perspective, what drives this type of learning bifurcation in the workplace?
Well, I think that the bifurcation you're describing is true not only for the workplace and technology. It's true for human response to change in general, that there's sort of a bell-shaped curve, and you've got early adopters who will do almost anything, and you've got resistors who will do very little, regardless of the merit, and then a whole group of people in between that are like settlers. And for Gen AI in particular, I think there's 3 things that lead to a real bifurcation. One of them is that it's a big fad. I began my journey with AI in 1970, over 50 years ago, when I was a graduate student. And I read the very first article published on AI in education, in which the author confidently predicted we wouldn't have teachers by the end of the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Well, that forecast wasn't too good. And I've lived through 9 hype cycles since then. And in each of those hype cycles, the optimists have predicted digital deities and the pessimists have predicted the Terminator, and they've always been wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And they're wrong in this hype cycle too. So the companies are overpromising because they don't yet have a business model that's successful for this. And there's just a huge amount of misinformation. And that makes the sort of early adopters all the more excited, and it makes the sort of late settlers all the more worried. And mm-hmm. that leads to a bifurcation. I also think there's a tension, and again, this is not unique to Gen AI, between using a new technology to do things better or to do better things.
Mm-hmm.
And most of what I see the technology being pushed to do is to take what we're already doing and do it faster, or do it politely more effectively, or do it cheaper. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But I think the real promise of the technology in terms of long-range improvement is doing better things, doing things like being able to practice negotiation in an immersive, authentic simulation rather than sitting through lectures on how to negotiate. And again, people are much more comfortable with doing things better than doing better things. And so that leads to kind of a bifurcation. And then in studying why people in education in particular are resistant to technology, I've looked at a field called knowledge diffusion, which has been around for about half a century, started with studying agricultural extension agents. But it finds the same thing in every form of human activity that involves change, which is that people say that what they want is evidence that the new change is more effective. But evidence is never in the top three reasons why they do something or don't do something. It's just kind of an excuse. And the single most powerful thing, if you want change, is to find influencers who a lot of people feel are, you know, kind of great practitioners. And then if the influencer starts doing something, then a lot of other people will follow. So because companies often don't focus on knowledge diffusion, instead they just sort of respond in surface ways to convincing people to change. Those efforts are largely ineffective.
I just want to sort of comment on your comment of your observation about doing things better versus doing better things. Mm-hmm. I think what's interesting with the AI use cases we see out there right now in the technology workspace is there are definitely use cases, and I'll call it, you know, efficiency versus effectiveness. So there's a lot of great efficiency. I need to create a proposal for a professional services engagement, or I need to create some content for a course. I can use AI to do things faster. But then there's also these cases of effectiveness where you can use Gen AI to do modeling around all kind of fun stuff like revenue forecasting or what customers to focus on that allows you to really do better things because you're spending your time differently because AI is, you know, helping with that. So it's fascinating that both those use cases are there already in the wild.
Just give you a specific example that relates to corporate half a century ago, the spreadsheet was the killer app that enabled desktop computing, and people were excited about the spreadsheet because it gave them a way of doing all these calculations faster. But then they realized that now they could ask what if questions. And that was the thing that was the doing better things, as you point out with modeling. And the same is true today.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, how do you view AI? Because you just brought up the spreadsheet was the killer app. And you also made the point already that we see this every time a new technology gets on the table, people go through these learning curves, et cetera. But AI itself, is it just another tool like Excel? Is it something really different and specifically in the way people are going to learn and onboard new skills, et cetera? How do you view AI?
Well, I'll talk about two things that are related to learning. The first one, which I think is underemphasized, is that as much as all forms of AI have the potential to improve education, as is also true with XR, the biggest shift is in the outcomes that we should be seeking.
Okay.
Because I study not only AI, but IA, intelligence augmentation, which is what happens when a human being and an AI partner and each does what it does well. And with AI, that's reckoning, calculative prediction. And with human beings, that's judgment, sort of applied wisdom based on a deep understanding of the real world context that AI doesn't have. And what we're doing, unfortunately, is mainly preparing people to do reckoning. So then they get to the place and they're John Henry against the steam engine. The AI is going to win. All the high stakes tests are reckoning tests. They're not judgment tests. And this is where the second part of your question comes in, that because of that change in outcomes, because of IA in the workplace, which is part of what drives the doing things better and doing better things, the immersive authentic simulations that I mentioned earlier coming out of my work with companies like Mersion and Wanda are really what's important, because they can measure things like judgment. They can measure your leadership or your ability to work with other people or your cultural understanding or your negotiation skills, or all things that AI is really not set up to do well at this point in its evolution. So I think that to successfully get to IA, which is where the real gain is with AI, we have to change how we learn and what we learn, and mainly how we assess, and the ability to assess performances as opposed to assessing seat time and performance on psychometric exams is the key to making that shift.
As I listen to that, you're sort of defining a world here where two things I'm hearing in terms of leveraging this next wave of technology. One is, just as I'm learning the skills, that can be different because, again, I can get in these simulations, et cetera. And assessing, did Thomas really learn that skill, is not about taking a written test or saying, yes, I understand the 7 points of, you know, solid negotiation. It's actually, we could see Thomas in action and we'll tell you if he's actually mastered those skills or not. Did I get that correctly?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's super interesting. And you're the first person to put this angle on the table here in Tectonic. So I think that is interesting. Every Tectonic listener is well aware I am a big believer that AI is a game changer for how professionals in the technology industry will do their jobs. TSI Research is not immune to that reality. I am proud to say that we have been aggressively experimenting on how AI can change the way we create research and deliver those research insights to our members. And now we are ready to release TSIA Intelligence, the first Gen AI model designed exclusively for technology services. Unlike generic Gen AI tools, TSIA Intelligence taps into our real-world, industry-validated data that is not in the public domain. We have designed this model to give you clear, actionable, and board-ready insights. Right now, in technology services, the stakes are really high. Every decision counts. Good decisions can build your career. Bad ones can end it. General LLMs are incredibly powerful, but you need specialized insights built on industry data that you can trust. That is TSI Intelligence. To check it out, visit tsi.com/intelligence. So let's take that world and apply it to corporate America, right? Which is what I deal with in this podcast and the technology industry. And, you know, what's your observation in terms of how management teams, companies understand the best way for their workforce to acquire and master new skills? I mean, what do you see there?
So I'll go back to the title of the institute that I'm part of, the AI Institute, which is Adult Learning and Online Education. And the adult learning is important because I have a colleague, Professor Ruth Canfer at Georgia Tech, and she's taught me that if you're doing professional development for a group that includes 20-year-olds, 40-year-olds, and 60-years-old, it's kind of like doing a workshop in a pre-college setting where you've got kindergartners, middle school students, and high school seniors in the same place.
Right? All in the same room.
All in the same room. That we forget what we know about developmental psychology when we get to adults. But in fact, it's just as profound as with kids. Wow. And, you know, a very quick summary of two of the points is that as most people get older, this is all talking about averages, as most people get older, their agility of their thinking goes down as part of the aging process, but their life experience typically goes up. And that means that they reason in a different way. And so your training, your corporate capacity building should take into account somebody's age and somebody's life experience, because most of the time you're going to want to personalize along those two dimensions if you really want to get a strong impact. That's something that we're working on and studying in this National AI Institute. The other is that increasingly in a global world and a very multicultural workplace and very disruptive and rapidly shifting contexts, the acquisition of cognitive skills is only part of the story, that you really have to have beliefs and dispositions that are pro-work and pro-social, that you need to understand ways to help your executive function if that's something that you struggle with in terms of self-regulation, that knowing a lot about culture and context is the key to a lot of things that workforces really value, like motivation and leadership. And so it's not just treating it as here's some information that you know, or here's a way of thinking that you need to do, or here's a new protocol that you have to follow. It's deeper than that. The AI is going to be the one that follows the protocols. You need people that invent. One of the interesting things that I've seen since the pandemic is that if you ask employers what they want in brand new hires, entry-level workers, not HR, not the HR, but the employer, what they want, they will list leadership and they will list complex problem solving, which has never been on the table before. But what happened with the pandemic was when command and control collapsed, it was the people that even at the entry level that had some leadership skills and some complex problem solving skills, who could kind of invent their role given that there was no guidance from above.
Yeah.
And in this world today, we all need that all the time.
Yeah.
To be reinventing, because we're constantly seeing things that nobody's ever seen before.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm curious, if you go into companies in general, if you just look at, again, corporate America, you look at a company, and we'll just take a, you know, we'll take a simple scale of, you know, 1 to 10. And in terms of how sophisticated and effective they are at training their workforce, right, on new skills, like there's complex problem solving, leadership, adopting new technologies. And one is, boy, these guys are really terrible. And 10 is, you know, I think they're, this is, you know, world-class, best-in-class practices here. Where do you find most companies on that range? Just give me a sense of what, how would you would assess typical companies at approaching education, if you will?
I'd give them a 2. And that's optimistic.
I thought you'd come out maybe 3 or 4.
That's,
I knew it was
optimistic.
Gonna be.
Now, if you ask me how successful at universities, including Harvard, at doing what they're supposed to do, I would give them a 3. So you have to understand the scale that I'm using is really based on what should be the case rather than just sort of grading everybody on a curve where there's a lot of A's.
Yeah. So let me click into that, because I'm sure even though if the average is 2 in your experience, there has to be some exemplars out there that you've run into. And so just, you don't have to say who it is, but just kind of describe the attributes. When you look at a company, you say, wow, they're not a 2. Maybe they're a 3 or 4 or 5. They're definitely doing a better job than their peers. What do you see there that they're doing differently?
I'll tell you what I see, but I'll also make a recommendation about who you might interview that can go much deeper on this.
Mm-hmm.
One of my recent doctoral students, now Dr. Tessa Forshaw, came to Harvard from Accenture and from a lot of other experiences, from Stanford and other experiences in workforce capacity building. And her dissertation was on studying next generation apprenticeships. And she documented within a company that I won't name the successful use of next generation apprenticeships, where you're not just shadowing somebody or you're not just getting some standard form of mentoring, but there's a whole suite of different kinds of experiences that you have. And there's a whole suite of how you go about capacity building that takes into account some of the things that I'm describing. I think that companies that successfully use apprenticeships are, and that doesn't mean only for entry-level workers, that every time your role changes, that you become an apprentice, if you will.
Yeah.
That's something that is worth talking to Tessa because of her studies of this, and that's something that, for me, would characterize what a successful company is, that you're not just getting pulled out to do some kind of corporate capacity building.
Mm-hmm.
Has its place, but really it's that every day, some of the time, you're an apprentice to somebody and you're developing a mastery of things that they know.
Yeah. It's interesting. And the reason that I'm sort of clicking into this is again, I think I can't assess companies like you do and give them a scale, but I intuitively believe that most companies are very weak in terms of their capabilities to help their workforces really, you know, effectively adopt new things, new skills, new technologies, et cetera. And what I'm seeing, again, just related to AI, is it really does change the daily workflows of every worker in a very significant way. And so for years, we've been rolling out new software systems, whether it's a CRM system or your ERP system or whatever system you're, I mean, that's been happening. But this is a very different scale. Once this technology really gets out there, everybody's going to be really impacted. And I think that companies are just woefully unprepared to get their workforce through this knothole. And they're saying, hey, there's this new AI tool, just go use it. It's going to be great.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's something the companies have to get their heads around because they want the efficiencies, they want the effectiveness, they believe there's a lot of there, but it's just not going to magically happen with a workforce.
Yeah. Two examples that come to my mind. One of them is again, out of the distant past that mm-hmm. I was part of. When word processing came out, I mm-hmm. remember how my university responded. They mm-hmm. found all the secretaries who were really fast typists, and they promoted them to be word processing experts.
Okay. Yeah.
And they put them in a special office, and because they didn't have to use correction tape and whiteout and stuff, yeah. they knew that they could crank things through faster and have fewer yeah. secretaries. What they completely missed, of course, was that you didn't need secretaries anymore, that people were going to do their own
word process
typing yeah. because it yeah, was yeah. a more powerful way of writing.
Yeah.
Because instead of thinking for 2 minutes and putting down something that's close to perfect, you were thinking for 10 seconds, putting down something, modifying it 5 seconds later, yeah. modifying it again 5 seconds later.
Yeah.
A more powerful way of writing than thinking.
Yeah.
So this is, again, the doing things better versus doing better things.
Mm-hmm.
You have to figure out what the real power of the technology is before yeah. you just start making organizational changes. Something that I'm thinking about with my colleagues now a lot is adaptive expertise. So people like nurses and other healthcare professionals learn all of these protocols, which are like recipes, and they're established on sound principles, and you just use them automatically as part of patient treatment, and it works well until there's a disruption.
Mm-hmm.
There's a terrorist event, or there's a huge railroad accident, or there's mm-hmm. a pandemic. And all of a sudden, you have 15 patients when you're supposed to have 3, and you have to use adaptive expertise because you can't mm-hmm. apply the protocols. The protocols are designed for taking much more time, and you won't have adaptive expertise if the protocols are simply things that you magically follow, like learning a spell in Harry mm-hmm. Potter. You have to understand the causal reasoning underneath the protocol so you know that you can leave out this step
mm-hmm.
and you're leaving out the hood ornament. You're not leaving out the engine
yeah.
in terms of the protocol. So one of the things I think in this very turbulent time that's going to continue for decades likely is that companies need to be building adaptive expertise rather than just stopping when they've got routine expertise.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting there. We had a guest on that sort of focuses on change management. And one of her points was that most companies, one of the challenges is they're telling their employees, okay, we're going to go through a change management process and you were operating in model A, we're going to go to model B, and then we're kind of done. But the reality is you're not done. You got to go to model C or model D, which is what you're saying. And yeah. so that's, to me, what I'm hearing is that's adaptive learning, is it that people get comfortable yeah. with the fact that there's a constant change here, tweaking your skills, tweaking the way you're doing things, there's a new, better way to do things, you know, and that's not easy for people, you know, especially once they master something and they're really confident in it. Facing tech companies today. How do we harness AI? Not just a buzzword, but as a revenue engine. How do we reimagine the customer experience to drive growth in a digital first world? And most importantly, are we ready to lead that change? Envision is where strategy meets execution, where data meets decision-making, and where the conversations that shape the future of our industry are happening in real time. Join us October 20th through the 22nd at the lovely Aria Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. You'll gain access to research-backed insights, proven frameworks, and real-world success stories to help your organization not just keep up, but lead. Register now at tsia.com/conference and walk away with clarity, tools, and the inspiration to turn today's uncertainty into tomorrow's opportunity. It leads to another question here around mental models, because I think this is something you've looked at as well as it relates to education and learning. You know, at TSI, we believe AI will fundamentally change the business models and the operating models and the organizational structures of technology companies. But these are business models and organizational structures that at this point in time have now been in place for decades and have been very successful. So I don't care if you're a salesperson with a model in mind on how to run sales or marketing or product engineering, doesn't matter. They all have these models that are deeply ingrained. It's their entire career. They work with these models. And now they're kind of getting blown up. And so what are some of the best practices to help workers unlearn old, outdated mental models and embrace the fact that they really have to look at new models?
Yeah, this is a topic that I've written on and thought a lot about unlearning. And I think the mistake often that people make is they think that unlearning is just cognitive. You've got one mental model, you substitute a different mental model, you show why it's better, and you kind of train people to think in a different way. But unlearning is at least as much emotional and social as it is intellectual, because as you said, people form an image of themselves as a successful salesperson or a successful librarian or a successful head of division.
Yeah.
And when you say, actually, no, you're going to have to learn a whole new way of doing this, you're proposing a profound challenge to their identity.
Mm-hmm.
And their identity in the new, brave new world of the change is not guaranteed. In fact, what we see is that often who is a high performer can shift. If in universities, for example, you can say, well, the people who can teach the giant lecture classes are terrific performers, which is true. But if you move away from the large lecture classes, because now we've got to prepare people with judgment and performance-based measures, as opposed to, you know, just dumping knowledge into them and giving them a high-stakes test, the people who are the best at being coaches and mentors aren't necessarily the people who are the best at being the high-stakes lecturers. And that's threatening. And then to add all of it, and I'm sure the change management person talked about this as well, even if the change is a good one, things get worse before they get better. You know how to do the old model. You don't know how to do the new model well. It's going to be trial and error to figure some things out. And if you panic because, you know, in the first month, then you're going to just lose the opportunity. So it's really a more complex process than just saying, hey, let's bring some people in that can explain cognitively this shift and give everybody revised recipes to follow. And then we'll just go from there. That's just the tip of the iceberg, really.
Yeah. Change management in general has just so many facets to it. It is so hard. And, you know, one of my observations after 40 years in the tech industry is tech likes to believe that it's an industry that loves change, loves disruption, is nimble, reacts quickly. I can tell you that is not true. That industry is no different than banking or any other education. Nobody likes change. Nobody likes change because it's super hard. And the other thing I think is important, people listening, that you pointed out is that in the change process, things, performance, efficiency, et cetera, usually gets worse before it gets better. And when it's getting worse is when it's easy for people to point and say, see, the old way was better. See, I told you this new way is just full of baloney. And you've got to power people through that. But the third thing I want to comment on, like you said, people that were really the strongest performers in the existing model, the traditional model, may or may not be in the new model. And there is a lot of fear there. I see that. There's a lot of risk. I see that, you know, lots of different positions where people are kind of internalizing that. And, you know, my belief and my coaching on that is, you're right, there is a lot of risk here. But what are your alternatives? Because these new models are, they're going to happen. And so either you are going to be a player there, you are going to be effective there, or you're on the sidelines. I mean, that's the way it's going to go. So I think every professional has to just look in the mirror and really internalize that. I kind of feel like, you know, this is non-negotiable, that, you know, this change. So, it's super interesting. You know, another question I wanted to ask, you know, you've warned against shiny object syndrome when it comes to technology and education specifically. And we've got these really fascinating use cases for AI and augmented reality and all this kind of fun stuff. But for technology leaders, how do you help, in this case, you know, corporate education folks that are leading that, how do you help them separate the hype from what technology can really do? Is there some guidance you can give there?
Well, I think the guidance would be that there are no magic beans that you can trade a cow for and all of a sudden you're living in clover the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And I'll use losing weight as an example. Over the decades, you see a million magic ways to lose weight that are promoted. And none of them work, right? None of them work. Not in a sustained way. None of them
work.
You
made a bunch of people depressed.
Because losing weight ultimately requires willpower and sustained performance and just never giving up. It's a constant struggle because of our physiology. So it's just so tempting because you don't want to go through that every day of your life. So you're always happy to hear about a new magic bean. And the same thing is true of learning. Learning is a struggle. Learning is something that you have to do continuously because, well, in 2020, I co-edited a book called The 60-Year Curriculum that was about new models of lifelong learning. Mm-hmm. And in 2020, we said in the book that we're moving into a period of incredible disruption and turbulence and chaos that's going to characterize the whole next generation, sort of like the generation born in the early 1900s was characterized by two world wars, a pandemic, mm-hmm. a Great Depression, you know, and the start of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. That was that kind of a period in history. And here we go again. And we talked about climate change and failure to reach all of the UN sustainability goals and technological advance. Well, since the book was written, we've had the pandemic, we've had Gen AI, and now we have incredible, you know, political turbulence going on across the world. So unfortunately, that forecast, if anything, was underestimated. And that just underscores the fact that learning, which is hard and which requires constant sort of vigilance in the way that not gaining weight requires constant vigilance, is going to be essential. Mm-hmm. And you've got to stay with theory and evidence-based innovations. Mm-hmm. And if I can be blunt, the tech industry is like the diet industry. They love to sell magic beans. Sure. And it's you know, for the tech industry, and I'm now talking about the big AI companies in particular, mm-hmm. to be honest about what's really going on isn't to their advantage. Mm-hmm. And so you end up with all this misinformation and, you know, magic that in the long run really doesn't help people and doesn't pay off.
Yeah. And I on board what you're saying there in terms of, you know, our industry does have a long history. We are always just one widget away from solving all the world's problems with our tech. And AI has a lot of those attributes. I think that what is interesting to me is, again, after 40 years in tech, even though that's true, it seems like we never learn our lesson. We always buy into the next cycle full circle. And then, but the only final caveat is having watched this for 40 years, I am personally super impressed with the already real impact and potential impact of AI technologies in so many use cases. It is the most impressive technology I've ever seen come out. I mean, you know, I lived through, you know, in the 90s, I was in Silicon Valley with the .com rush and everything. And I thought that was amazing the first time I got on a web browser. I thought that was magic. But it took a long time for that to really change the way that we're operating. I think this is going to move faster, which goes back to the point of really have to be leaning into how you're going to help your employees get there. This isn't going to magically happen. You being very sophisticated, not being a two, being a four or a five on how you help, you know, your employees get educated on new skills and competent, I think is going to be super important.
And for universities as well. I'm as critical of my own industry as I am of the tech industry.
Yeah. And so, you know, and I think that, you know, kind of thinking about futures, where do you see, you know, the future for academic institutions and enterprise education maybe work better to help with this lifelong learning? I mean, how do both of those entities need to change the way they're operating to create a better model here?
So the National Institute that I'm part of is a good example of this. Mm-hmm. We have established strong partnerships with for-profits like Wiley. Mm-hmm. We have a strong relationship with the Technical College System of Georgia, which is not community colleges, not vocational technical schools, but not standard four-year colleges either. It's a very unique kind of a system that helps about 500,000 people a year with workforce entry. And we have a really good partnership with them. It's also interesting, beyond that model from the National Institute, that Georgia Tech, for the first time in 33 years, has established a new college. It's the College of Lifetime Learning. And so they're making a big bet on the idea that intermittent education, where you go and get some kind of a certificate and pay a lot of money, is, and then you wait till you need another upgrade, mm-hmm. is not the way that it's going to be. That it's going to be, you know, apprenticeships and continuous lifelong learning. And what does that look like? What does that model look like? Could you have that within a university setting? So I think that there are some emerging insights and emerging models that are well worth paying attention to.
As I listen to you there, and I'm glad to hear that that type of experimentation is going on, because, you know, I've read and heard so much about what an abysmal job we did as a nation when, you know, manufacturing really started to shrink, and there was a concept of, well, you know, that's okay. We're going to retool people. You know, they used to do, we were manufacturing, we're going to get them in something else. And quite frankly, you know, we didn't stick the landing on that. Those programs were abysmal in terms of being effective. And what makes me nervous is, you know, so that happened, if you will, to the quote, blue collar worker. That wave is now coming to the white collar worker, to the knowledge worker, and in volumes like we've never seen before. And so if we don't have models that help people retool to be effective in, you know, whatever this new economy looks like, that is going to be a massive problem for us socially. And so I'm hoping the kind of things you're talking about, that it's like these old educational models, whether traditional universities, whether traditional corporate reach or anywhere, are not going to cut it. And we got to take that seriously.
Yeah, I mentioned Tessa Forshaw, and on her dissertation committee, you know, I looked at a lot of her work, and she found a study where they contrasted people who had received formal workforce reskilling and re-education when their job was disappearing versus people who didn't get anything formal, who just were basically left to their own devices to figure it out. The people who got the formal reskilling did worse.
My God. I'm not familiar with that study.
It had a negative effect.
It aligns with everything else I've read. Yeah.
So it's scary. Yeah.
Crazy.
Because we've got to do a better job of that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, on that note, I really appreciate you you coming in here today and sharing your perspective. I wish you well and the work that you're doing. I think it's really important work at this point in time and in our society. And I always close this with a question of the day. And so for everybody out there, what are your strategies to adopt and leverage AI in your day-to-day workflows? Cheers, everybody. One of the main reasons we founded TSIA almost 20 years ago was to establish accurate operational benchmarks for technology service businesses that just didn't exist anywhere. Benchmarking is a killer tool to quickly understand your strengths and weaknesses. Benchmarking sets you on a journey that starts with where you are, points to what is possible, and identifies the business practices that will get you there. That's why I am super excited we decided to offer a free version of TSI's industry-leading benchmarks with Performance Optimizer. Performance Optimizer is an easy-to-use benchmarking tool you can access from the TSI website. You can assess operational strengths and weaknesses in multiple areas, like customer success, professional services, support services, etc. And the Optimizer results prescribe specific actions to address specific challenges and opportunities. This is an amazing offer, and I am so proud we are doing this for all of our loyal Tectonic listeners who may not be corporate TSIA members. To check it out, visit tsia.com/free.